Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much money does it take to eat healthfully? An estimated 1 billion people in the developing world scrape by on a dollar a day or less. And in this country, federal nutrition benefits amount to just over $4 per person per day. Is that enough? My guest today had an epiphany a couple of years ago when he and his partner, who both teach high school in Southern California, were taken aback by their weekly spending at their favorite grocery store. So they decided to see what life is like for people who literally can't afford to eat right. They spent a month trying to feed themselves on that dollar a day and then moved up to the amount that federal food aid currently provides to a record number of struggling Americans. They blogged about it in real time and now have published a book recounting their experiences. Christopher Greenslate is co-author with Carrie Leonard of On a Dollar a Day, One Couple's Unlikely Adventures in Eating in America. Christopher, welcome to Think.
Good morning. Welcome. I guess it's afternoon where you are.
It's afternoon here, but that's okay. You know, it's one thing to consider the fate of people living on a dollar a day, and it's entirely another to voluntarily step into their shoes. Will you talk about what you sort of went through mentally that you decided you would actually go through with this?
Well, it, you know, like many things, it was pretty accidental. The unexpected seems to take hold a lot of times. So it really started when Carrie and I were at the grocery store, and we were walking out one day, and I could see a look on her face. She was a little befuddled, and she said, you know, our grocery bills are just way too expensive. And this was before the recession really hit, and so I made a comment. I was kind of joking around to kind of poke at the privilege that we so much enjoy and said, well, you know, there's about a billion people who live on a dollar a day or less, so we really, you know, don't have much to complain about. And she gave me a look. I said, well, we could try it. And so it kind of started as a joke. And then the idea, though, never went away. Every time I went to the grocery store, Carrie had the same kind of feeling. And then over months of kind of talking about it, we decided that we would just try it and see if we could do it. Not necessarily as a political thing, just to see if we could survive this kind of weird idea.
And when she writes in the book, it sounds as if you were fully convinced that this was happening and she was still sort of toying with the idea at the moment that you got started.
Yeah, there are many instances where I say things and I am serious, even though several other people might think I'm joking. So she eventually said, yeah, okay, well, let's try it. And then the blogging experience, all that, I threw that at her last minute, too, and just said, by the way, we're going to blog about this so that, you know, our family and our friends can kind of follow along and give their insights as well.
Your students were really interested in this project, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah, all my students, but in particular my social justice students, were very much interested just in a lot of the different aspects of this. First, in the kind of the dynamics of the issue, you know, eating and economics and health and environmental issues, all that stuff that we kind of pack into what's for lunch. That is are all topics they were concerned about, but also they were really interested in kind of the dynamic of how do you get people to look at an issue differently when they're, you know, kind of bombarded with all kinds of issues and messages on a daily basis. And so it really helped spawn a new activity in the class called Left Hook, where with their own projects in class, they have to find a way to pique people's interest so that they'll pay attention to the issues the students are trying to advocate for in that course. So it really was helpful. You know, there was one student who decided his project was on teen homelessness in our area, and so he decided he wasn't going to shower until he had raised X number of dollars. And so he just stopped showering, and he started a campaign called Let Kai Shower. They really kind of took that the spirit and went further with it than I think even we did. But, you know, they didn't get the coverage that we got.
What kind of planning was required before you actually started this?
Honestly, we didn't really do very much planning at all. We bought a book called, I think it's Eat Well on a Dollar a Day by Bill and Ruth Kasing.
From like the 80s, right? The early 80s.
Yeah, it was definitely older than I am. I'm 29, and I was born in 80. So I think it was even from maybe the 70s. And so I read that. It was a quick read. And that was about all the preparation that we had, was just the ideas there. And some of the things they talked about were, you know, buying in bulk, even going to like a feed store if you have one in your area and getting the best deal, or foraging for certain things in your area. So some of the stuff you can see that come through in On a Dollar a Day, where, you know, there's a scene where actually I'm trying to forage for oranges in our area. And of course, if you've read it, you'll know what happens. But that was all the preparation we did. It wasn't much more than that.
Did it help that you're vegans? Because I can't imagine that even if you had wanted meat, you could have afforded it.
Honestly, yeah, I think that it really did. We didn't have very many options with when you're dealing with a budget that tight. It really was what can we get that's going to be filling, that's going to have, you know, some semblance of the calorie count we were used to. So we ended up eating a lot of beans and rice, polenta from, you know, cornmeal. Yeah, there wouldn't have been much opportunity for us to purchase meat or dairy products at all, or their, you know, faux counterparts either.
And starting out, you went to, I guess, like one of the big warehouse type of stores and got like plastic bins to put all this bulk food into?
Well, yeah, I mean, essentially we went to Home Depot and got those, you know, those construction buckets. And then from the materials, the food materials that we bought, those came from like a wholesale store out here called Smart and Final. They generally cater to restaurants. So restaurants will go there and buy, you know, a 50-pound bag of flour. But that was the best way to get the best cost per ounce of whatever product we were buying. And so we just, you know, dumped those into the bins, and they had, you know, super airtight lids. And yeah, we ate from those. And in fact, we still have all of those bins from that first initial experiment. And we just got to the end of our 50-pound bag of flour last week.
It's really interesting. Toward the end of the book, I think Carrie writes that having that food around even after you were finished with your experiment caused you to think a lot more about what you had at home. And in some cases, you didn't have to go out and shop for things. You were sort of forced by its existence to use what you had already.
Well, yeah, and especially leading up to the first experiment, the dollar experiment, Carrie, you know, there's a scene where she's, you know, kind of slamming cupboard doors looking for things to eat. And I kind of insist that we have food, we're just not looking at it the way maybe we should be looking at it. So when I say we had food, I mean that means we had things like flour and shortening and, you know, some raw materials. And she was thinking of, you know, we don't have food, as in we didn't have a bag of tortillas handy. And so, you know, that was one of those moments where I said, well, you know, it's the things you just never think that you'll think about, like the fact that there are millions of people making tortillas right now. And so it's got to be something that we can figure out. I mean, we're college educated. I'm sure we can figure out how to make a tortilla. And that's how, kind of the first clue to how much we had to learn was little moments like that. So I started rolling out tortillas. I figured out how to make them and started rolling them out, and that was just before we started. And so we didn't want to go to the store until we started. So, yeah, I really did push, like, let's eat everything we have and get rid of it. And so we started learning before we even got into the experiment.
Well, it really does drive home how much time it takes. If it doesn't take money to make tortillas at a fraction of the cost of buying a package of them in the grocery store, it's hours every day, which you guys each have one job but no kids. You're aware that there are people who have a lot more sort of time obligations and still have to eat this way.
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, recently we were talking with someone, and they were, you know, kind of, you know, awestruck about, you know, how did you do that? And it just came out. I said, well, you know, we spent more time. You know, we didn't spend money. We spent more time. And that was really what it came down to. I think that in our research for the book, Raj Patel, who's the author of Stuffed and Starved, and used to work at this food development think tank in the Bay Area, comments that we spend, on average, as Americans, about 7 minutes preparing food in the day. That's come down from, you know, hours that we used to spend. And in some ways, in some regards, that's a huge kind of symbol of progress, that if you do have children, you don't really have the time to be rolling out tortillas. I mean, that's, you know, kind of obvious. At the same time, though, some of those skill sets, those things that we used to do that were so central to our everyday existence have gone away. We don't know how to do them. And so we're relying on the more kind of processed, convenient foods that are prepackaged, which means we have less power in deciding the things that we eat, unless we go back and figure out how people used to feed themselves and not, you know, get super fat.
Another interesting issue that I gather was unexpected that came up for you both was the idea of sort of traditional gender roles, in that you hadn't talked about it and said, okay, Carrie, you're going to do all the cooking and I'm going to do all the whatever guy stuff. But it turned out to be something that caused some resentment for her.
Yeah, it's funny. When Carrie and I first met, excuse me, I was vegan and she wasn't, and so I was doing a lot of the cooking. And as she was transitioning from being vegetarian to vegan, she started taking on kind of more responsibilities. So the shift in, you know, responsibility kind of moved more in her direction as she became fluent in cooking a lot of the things that we're accustomed to eating now. And so from there, I just never seemed to grasp any of the responsibility back from her and say, you know, this needs to be more equitable in the kitchen. So, yeah, we started to slip into traditional gender roles, which are things that You know, they may work for some folks. They definitely don't work for how I see myself as someone who wants to be, you know, an equal partner in the relationship. So we definitely saw a lot of that. Carrie definitely felt more of the burden, and rightfully so, 'cause she was doing more of the cooking in the home. But there are things we don't write about, like I was doing, you know, a lot of the cleaning and the dishes. So some of that kind of played out in a way that's balanced, but mostly, yeah, it really gave us a reality check on the way we treat each other, especially if you've been, you know, with high school students for 10 hours a day, and then you come home and you've got to figure out, you know, exactly how much you can eat for 33 cents or whatever. It definitely, in that kind of scenario, heightens anxiety, heightens stress, and so those things definitely came through in the book as a result of the experience.
And being hungry and having only things to eat that weren't necessarily, you guys both sort of fantasize about your favorite burrito place throughout the book. It also affected your relationship, and you just didn't feel very good.
Yeah, you know, in the first few days, and I talk about this in the book, I actually felt better. I felt like I was eating reasonable portion sizes, because we had a tendency beforehand to kind of overeat. I was raised with, you know, you eat everything on your plate, doesn't matter how much you're served. And so that childhood kind of experience definitely, you know, has some serious impact on the way I eat as an adult. And so the first few days I definitely felt better. I thought, you know, I feel lighter. I feel like I've got more energy. But as the month wore on, those feelings definitely subsided, and it got harder to have the same level of energy. There were days that I write about, you know, in class where I have to hold on to my lectern because I'm feeling lightheaded, and actually go to the school nurse, and, you know, she says, drink water. That's what Gandhi did. And so, you know, there were those moments where it was definitely, I reconsidered what was happening, and that grew, especially when I saw the amount of weight I was losing. I weighed at the time probably about 212 or so, and I'm 6'2". And it became very clear at least halfway through that I was losing about 2 pounds every other day or so. So, I mean, I ended up losing 14 pounds, and, I mean, people could see it. I remember coming into class one day, and a young student of mine, she said, Mr. Greensley, you don't look very good. And secretly, I'm thinking, well, this is great, I'm losing weight. but I learned later from one of the people who was reading our blog, who's a doctor and nutritionist in Pittsburgh, he wrote, you know, the reason you're losing weight is this, and, you know, you should definitely be a little more concerned than you are. My mom was using our blog as kind of a health lesson for her fifth graders. Mm-hmm. They were following along, and they had to write about it every night, and they were definitely worried. So my mom started calling the house, especially in the third week, and was saying things like, you guys need to stop. This has gone too far. You know, and it got to the point where we stopped answering the phone when we saw that it was her calling. So, yeah, it definitely wasn't healthy. I think that had we had more planning and more experience, and had we been raised with the skill sets, what is a healthy balanced meal, and how do you cook things from raw ingredients, we would have been better off. But, you know, we had no way of getting that experience other than just kind of jumping in and seeing what it was like.
Well, we're going to take a quick break now, but I want to talk after that break about what changed when you moved up to something like $4.13 a day, which is the amount that people who receive federal food assistance get, and how hard it still was at that point. Christopher Greenslate is my guest. He's the author with Carrie Leonard of the new book On a Dollar a Day, One Couple's Unlikely Adventures in Eating in America. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes now available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author and high school teacher Christopher Greenslate. His new book, written with Carrie Leonard, is called On a Dollar a Day, One Couple's Unlikely Adventures in Eating in America. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So I want to talk, Christopher, about what happened after this initial month. You live on a dollar a day each, and then you decide to move up to the amount of money given to people who are on federal nutritional benefits. And we should say there is an unprecedented number of Americans who qualify for these benefits right now.
Yeah, I think that what happened at the end of the first experiment is we were just left with all kinds of questions. You know, the dollar a day as a poverty indicator is kind of outdated. It's actually, at this point, estimated by the World Bank, $1.25 a day. The first thing I want to clear up, though, is the misconception that a lot of people said, oh, well, a dollar a day goes further in Bangladesh than it does here. But the World Bank has already done that kind of formulaic exchange, and so it's called purchase power parity, and so the $1.25 or the dollar, whichever, is actually a real example or a reasonable way to consider what absolute poverty means. So we were thinking a lot about that, and then we thought, well, here in America, we've got the federal assistance programs like WIC and food stamps, which is now called SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And so we kind of asked ourselves, what would it be like to do that? What would it be like to see what we could eat based on that allotment? And we knew that several other people had done it before. We knew that there was a CNN guy who did it. There was some, the governor of Oregon did it. Some other politicians did it. And they did it for a week. And they ate on $3 a day. Recently, that amount has gone up, but we stuck with that number because that's kind of been the average over the last few years. But what we did that was different is that we added the amount of money that the federal government, the Economic Research Service, which is a branch of the USDA, we added the amount of money that they suggest that you also spend as a recipient in addition to what they give you. And so we took the average amount income, and we took 30% of that because they expect you'll spend 30% of your income on food. And we added that, and that was like $1.13. So we added that to the $4, and that gives us the number we came to. And so in addition to using that number, because we were kind of aware of the criticism that, the food stamp diet challenge, isn't accurate because it's supposed to be a supplement. It's not supposed to be the whole amount. So that's why we did that. But the other thing we did is we followed the Thrifty Meal Plan, which is the USDA's kind of guide or suggested guide that has recipes and a meal plan in it for a couple weeks to help families make decisions about the things to buy and the things to make. So we tried as best we could to translate, first of all, that guide into something that we could do that was obviously vegan. So whenever there was things like milk, we'd have soy milk instead, or ground beef, we'd have the alternative to that. So we did that, and then we set out to see if we could follow that guide with that amount, and that's the whole second part of the book.
And what's so interesting there is that you're no longer simply eating just to fill your stomach. You have the ability to make some decisions, and yet it was still tough to get foods that were fully nutritious and filled you up and really satisfied your need to eat properly.
Yeah, and it would have been easier if we weren't following the plan. Like if we had just put the Thrifty Meal Plan in the dustbin and said, we're going to plan our own meals. And try and base them on the food pyramid or the My Pyramid stuff and see how that works. That would have been a whole lot easier, especially coming from a dollar a day, right? You come from a dollar a day and it's like $4 is like you've hit a gold mine. But following that plan was really, really difficult. And in doing so, we actually ran out of money. We didn't even make it through the end of the month because we just couldn't make anything left on the plan with the allotment that we had given to ourselves. So it really was kind of eye-opening to see that this suggested guide that the USDA puts out is really, for a lot of reasons, not really a great tool for folks who are struggling to try and eat well with a limited income.
Christopher Greenslate is my guest. The new book is called On a Dollar a Day. Join us at 1-800-933-5372, where we find John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi, Chris. Years ago, my wife and I didn't have our kids for a week, and we challenged each other to live on $30 for the week, shopping at Central Market, which is our normal place to go.
Okay.
And we made it 6 days. We lived for the first 6 days. We didn't quite make it the seventh day, which is about $2.50 a day.
Wow.
And we ate chicken, we ate cheese, rice, hibiscus tea, bananas, eggs. And we proved that we could do it, but we know we couldn't do it with kids because, you know, they, I don't think they tolerate it, and it would be tough to sustain. But even the $250 a day, that's far less than what most people spend. So either on a nutritional basis, economic basis, spiritual basis, whatever, it can be done and not having to eat ramen and that type of thing. But it takes a lot of discipline, you know, smaller portions, you know, intentional eating, intentional shopping. And it saves a lot more time for other things. But I just wanted to let your guests know that, we had tried this before it became, you know, de rigueur, but it works, and it works in Central Market or Whole Foods.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, and if I could just respond, he's absolutely right. It does work, but he's also correct that it takes an intense amount of discipline. And then, you know, if you have the freedom to kind of make what you want to make and you know how to make the things that you like to eat, absolutely. And that's something that we learned as well.
Another thing that's really interesting is you talk here about food waste, and later on, when you're just trying to eat healthfully, you join a community-supported agriculture program, and you know they give you sort of a variety of locally grown fruits and vegetables, including things that neither of you could stand, and yet you found yourselves unable to just toss those.
Yeah, we definitely weren't going to throw anything away. In fact, Carrie talks pretty specifically about food waste as teachers. You know, we see kids every day with the food they bring to school, and a lot of it I wouldn't even call food. It's just junk. But even with the junk, you know, like there's one kid I think she writes about who every day he throws away this, you know, certain flavor of granola bar or something, just maybe because he just doesn't like it or whatever. And, you know, apples that are, you know, left to rot in the quad and, you know, all kinds of things that she talks about, you know, wanting to have. And so the food waste stuff for Carrie I think was pretty surprising. For myself, it wasn't as surprising at all. I had spent some time working with an organization called Food Not Bombs, where we actually took the waste, you know, quote-unquote waste, the leftover food items that people weren't going to eat, and, you know, fed folks who had no homes or no sustenance with those excesses of American food. And so I think that it's, you know, it's very clear that Americans do not like to see things wasted. And, you know, if you talk about how there's, you know, so much food being wasted on a daily basis and there's people going hungry, I think people get even more frustrated and upset by that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. You know, it seems to me that starving in America is very different than starving in the rest of the world, at least stereotypically, when you think of the stereotype.
Sure.
You know, the rest of the world, we're talking emaciated figures. We typically think of Africa. Here in America, when you think of the working poor, you think of people who are either morbidly obese or struggling with weight issues. Or, I wonder if you could talk about the paradox that exists here in America, specifically talk about the conditions that Americans, the working poor, have to address when just trying to exist, trying to feed themselves. In other words, those conditions that are unique to America. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem. I'll do the best I can. Traveled to East Africa twice in the last year. I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm working with students and teachers and communities there. It is quite different. When you're in a village in, you know, rural Uganda, just up from the source of the Nile, you know, they're doing everything they can to make sure they've got enough to eat. A lot of kind of subsistence farming, they still have those skills. Ironically, they know how to create food from, you know, just dirt and seed and water and sunlight. But here in America, you're right, it's far different. Not only do we not have the skill set, because farming has become, you know, such a part of a small percentage of Americans' daily lives and of Americans' daily work, we really are faced with enormous challenges in deciding where to spend our money, how to get the most for our money, and, you know, not become overweight, have early onset diabetes and other things. Part of the reason I think, and I hope this answers your question, that we see those problems, that the paradox, and you're correct in using that word, I think, is that you've got folks who are hungry. They're faced with what the government calls a food insecurity, meaning, you know, they'll go a certain day without eating, you know, enough, or they'll go for periods where they've got enough food and then periods where they don't. So it's really kind of touch and go. But you also find that a lot of those folks are overweight, or just, you know, Americans in general faced with an obesity epidemic. Part of the problem, and this was stated in the New York Times article that we originally appeared in, and they took research from Washington where they did a study, and University of Washington found that the foods that were cheapest were the things that were the most calorie dense. So you're getting a lot of calories for a really inexpensive amount. Now, that doesn't mean junk food is less expensive than, you know, oranges and apples. It's not. But on a calorie kind of cost level, it is. So you can get more calories from a Twinkie that, you know, costs you 75 cents than you will from the apple that costs you maybe 25 cents. So a lot of the foods that we eat are just packed with calories, and those are the things that are cheapest and most accessible. We've got more fast food restaurants than kind of sit-down family places. You've got more people eating out than cooking at home because of the skills or time or whatever. And so, you do find that if we kind of rest our responsibilities on how we eat and how we gain our nutrition from folks who are selling things that aren't very good for us, it's going to be a problem. We're going to gain weight. School lunches, we have the same issue. You've got, you know, kids drinking chocolate milk, they get it subsidized, whatever, but you've got that sugar in there, and of course it adds to obesity. So it is quite a paradox. We've got people who are facing food insecurity. Some of those folks are the same folks who are dealing with obesity. And then, you know, it's just the larger kind of problems that our country faces with obesity are also pretty compelling. And I hope that some of those issues will be addressed by Michelle Obama's initiative about childhood obesity. But I'm finding, as I spoke with a reporter in Chicago yesterday who was there touring their lunch system, that a lot of the economics are trumping kind of the healthy options. They're saying instead of, you know, original Lay's, we're going to give the kids baked Lay's. But when we did that, we saw a drop in sales of 60%. And, you know, I was floored. I thought, well, who cares, first of all? Run the program at a loss, you know, because we're feeding kids here and we're developing habits and they need good nutrition at school. So run it at a loss. We run the arts at a loss. You know, we can do that. Well, let's make money other places. Let's get them the nutrition they need. The other part is chips, you know, whether they're baked or original or fried, they're not healthy at all. So someone, in addition to kind of finding the way we can eat healthy for cheap, and we've proven that you can make better choices with less money, you also have to have kind of the political will for people to stop, you know, kind of subsidizing the things like, you know, corn and soy that are so prevalent, we eat way too much of them, that will make us fat. We need to reinvest in kind of, you know, fruits and vegetables and really, you know, get those out to folks in a way that is convenient and accessible.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Grapevine and speak with Jackie. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A comment and a question real quick.
Sure.
My daughter attends a charter school, and 35% of the children are on free lunch.
Sure.
I went to look at the catering company to see the what minimum standards they're following, and it's the USDA minimum standards.
Yeah.
The majority, I'd say 95% of the menu is fat, carb, and sugar.
Sure.
How do we change that? Thank you.
Any thoughts, Christopher?
I think that there's a lot of things we can do, and you're absolutely right. And I think most schools follow those minimum requirements. Schools are in a funny place specifically because the schools are strapped for cash. They don't have a lot of money, if any, to really do some niceties that we would like or used to. I wouldn't say health is a nicety, but there are other people who would see it that way. We do need to address it. I would say that some of the things that you might notice at school lunch programs or breakfast programs is that there's no cutlery, right? They're eating things that they can eat with their hands.
Or on a stick, yes.
Right. They're eating, you know, they're eating a hot dog, a hamburger, chicken nuggets, pizza, chips, you know, things like that. So I'd say the first thing we can do is serve meals that you have to eat with a fork. I mean, as simple as that. And, you know, I think that little changes like that, or the ideology of that, eat with a fork, will hopefully make some changes in the decisions. Or maybe you set a rule that we don't feed children anything that has more than 5 ingredients in it, because at that point it's not food anymore. It's food with a bunch of other added materials. And, of course, the other thing is we need to double the fruits and vegetables that we feed kids. It's not good enough to give chocolate milk for breakfast with a Rice Krispie treat or some type of, you know, fruit roll-up or something that's loaded with sugar, and then also at lunch give them a pizza, you know, made with whole wheat flour. Even though whole wheat is better than the refined white, you know, they're still eating pizza. It's still not, you know, as healthy as they could be eating. So we need to really shift the ideology that kids deserve, you know, whole, fresh, nutritious food. Lots of fruits and vegetables, less meat and dairy, less sugars, less you know, fats, all that stuff, and with reasonable portion sizes, and maybe they can eat with a fork.
Well, you know, it's really interesting, and you're around teenagers all day. I have four kids in the public schools, and what strikes me about the way that they're fed there if they buy their lunch is that, yeah, the assumption is made that no child will eat anything other than pizza or some kind of chicken sandwich thing that's been breaded.
Yeah.
And I think there are plenty of American kids who don't eat that way at home, and yet those are the choices at school because people think kids only like pizza and chips and fries.
Yeah, and that gets back to what I was saying is, you know, about the people say, oh, well, they won't eat it, so we can't make money. Well, I'm sorry, but if you're hungry, you'll eat an apple, right? If you're not hungry, you won't eat it. But giving a kid, and this is what I was talking to a reporter from Chicago yesterday about, and she's right at the intersection of all these things because Chicago Public Schools is up to bid for their new kind of meal services, so they're putting that up to bid, and Michelle Obama's got her thing starting there. And someone really has to say, we're going to feed kids these things, and this is what's available. And, you know, if they don't like it, you know, I'm sorry. Like, we're setting a precedent here saying the things you like, they are killing you. They will literally kill our children if we keep feeding them these things. So in the quantities that we do, you know, if we taught them about balance, that would be one thing, but we're not. So in addition to setting the example, we also need to, you know, teach kids about food, where it comes from, how to grow it, how to cook it, how to serve it. All those things should be part of education. And so I really look forward to the continuing kind of school foods conversation because it is totally essential to our country's health.
When you felt physically hungry, especially during that month, did you find that your taste preferences sort of fell away?
I'm sorry, can you ask me again?
When you, in that first month, and now I'm only going to leave you a few seconds before we need to take a break, but when you were physically hungry a lot during that month when you ate on a dollar a day, did you find that the things that you, the vagaries of taste sort of fell away and you would eat what was there?
Oh, absolutely. It didn't matter what it was. I mean, I was so hungry that I would have eaten almost anything on those days, yeah.
Christopher Greenslate is with us. He is the author, along with Carrie Leonard, of the new book On a Dollar a Day, One Couple's Unlikely Adventures in Eating in America. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes now available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Christopher Greenslate, whose new book, written with Carrie Leonard, is called On a Dollar a Day, One Couple's Unlikely Adventures in Eating in America. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk for a minute about this thing. Sometimes they're called food deserts. You call it food apartheid. The reality that, depending on where you live, it may be much more difficult than we'd imagine to find foods that are both affordable and healthful.
Yeah, sure, and you know, I'll clarify too. There's a reason why we say food apartheid, because the person who originally did the research, she called them food deserts. These places where, you know, the urban poor don't have access to fresh and healthy foods. It's not even a matter of, you know, what their education level is or what they're, you know, they're going to buy, but that they just simply couldn't buy them because they weren't around. They were, you know, forced to shop at, you know, corner stores and bodegas and things like that. If you don't have transport to get to the real supermarket, you're kind of limited, especially if you've got, you know, fast food everywhere, which gets back to that kind of obesity thing as well in the urban poor areas. But I think, yeah, specifically, we call it food apartheid because the woman who did that research, she never went to any of those areas. She just didn't go there. So to call it a desert, I think, is kind of strange. So we really thought that it was more, there are political reasons why people don't have access. There are kind of practical reasons, like, you know, grocery store, you know, the cost of operating in an area where they perceive there's more crime, et cetera, are higher than operating in the suburbs. But that doesn't change the reality of the situation. That is that people are really struggling or completely denied access to fresh and healthy food. So that's why we call it apartheid. It's not that they have a choice in the matter. They can't just, you know, go find it. But there is something that's very interesting. Recently, the Economic Research Service, which is a department of the USDA, who tracks and studies all of these things. In fact, we relied on a lot of their reports and their magazine, Amber Waves, for a lot of our kind of background research. Not that we cite it in the book, but we rely on it for some of the foundations. And there's a new website that they have, and it's called Food Environment Atlas. So it's Your Food Environment Atlas, and I think it's ers.usda.gov/foodatlas. And you can enter the atlas, and what's really fascinating is that it's got the whole country out there as a map. And you can look very specifically at certain aspects of where healthy food is available, even down to where there's a supermarket or not a supermarket within a mile of a certain destination, how many fast food restaurants are there as opposed to more like, you know, family restaurants or sit-down restaurants. It even has food eaten at home versus food eaten out, food insecurity. Then it gets down to even mapping the amount of benefits, the SNAP benefits, or formerly called food stamps, WIC benefits, health, local foods, physical activity levels. I mean, there's just like a list of about a dozen things that you can look at across the country, depending on which county you want to click on. And under those, you can go to the sub-things if you really want to get specific. And so we've been playing with that map just because it's wonderfully kind of developed. It doesn't let you do some cross comparisons, you know, like if you've got this many people accessing SNAP benefits, how likely are they able to use or get to a place that has fresh fruits and vegetables. It doesn't let you do double analysis, not that I can tell yet, but at the very least, the Food Environment Atlas online lets you look at some specific things, and you can look at all of them for a certain county. So if you want to know the access and proximity to grocery stores, the availability of food stores, the availability of restaurants, you can look at all of those things for a certain county, and it's very telling. And on the map, it color codes it for you, so you can see where the most food stamp benefits are going across the country and then even within states, and it's really fascinating stuff.
Can you talk very briefly about why there are a lot of people, millions of Americans, who qualify for supplemental food assistance who don't receive those benefits?
We found, you know, and it's funny, we were talking to someone else and they said, well, did you interview people who were on food stamps? And the answer was no, not specifically. And we felt kind of uncomfortable doing that. We didn't want, first of all, we're not trained sociologists or trained researchers in food, so we didn't want to just try and do that and say that that's a representative of other folks. But we did talk to several kind of experts, especially in our area, experts in our area. And then we also talked to our families. So, you know, I grew up on WIC. My mom, you know, had to get access to WIC in order to help me develop as a young child. Carrie's family, her parents both talked about, you know, being on food stamps prior to Carrie being born. And so we talked to our friends and family, and we talked to some experts, and really what we found is that there's a lot of reasons why someone wouldn't get the benefits that they are you know, entitled to or that are allowed to them. And they're varied. So some of it comes down to just plain misconceptions. We talked to folks who, you know, said that people are afraid to sign up for food stamps or SNAP because they fear that the government will later say you owe them this amount of money. So there's some just really serious misconceptions as far as like the outreach and education in certain cities and counties about how you go about getting those benefits. There's also, and especially in our area, we learned we were at the heart of kind of the worst food stamp problem in the country. So San Diego is the worst performing urban area in regards to food stamps. And what that means is of the people who are eligible, we only get benefits to 30% of those folks. And the reasons in the research in this area are because it takes about 5 different visits to a caseworker, and you have to see the same person every time, an average of 5 visits. And that's a lot of time, especially if you're working poor. You just can't leave your job 5 times to try and get benefits to see the same person, and they may be out sick or whatever. That you have to have everyone in the home fingerprinted who's going to be living there while someone in the house is getting benefits. You know, you have to go to a center, and especially in our area, there's even some with bulletproof glass, and they're located in places that are perceived as very unsafe, and so there's a risk in even going to the office at all. So there's kind of some of those logistical obstacles that make people very uncomfortable. You know, who wants the DA just showing up at their house randomly, which is something that was happening every now and then to try and prevent fraud, quote-unquote, even though fraud is only 2 to 4% in the state of California. But what's really unfortunate, and it's not just that people aren't getting the help they need, is that our county and our state, especially in the budget crisis, we're losing a ton of money that we could be getting from the federal government, and that the use of food stamps actually generates economic activity, and that was really surprising for us. So I think it's something like, you know, for every dollar spent that's from SNAP, it generates $1.84 in economic activity. And that means that our county was losing something on the number of $150 million. And then our state, you know, was exponentially more. California is the worst in the nation. We're, you know, 50% participation rate for those who are eligible. And so we were just floored, you know, especially now in these times, that our county and our state should really be trying to get as many people the benefits they can get, because it helps all of us in our area. So it was really a fascinating thing to learn that we were at the heart of kind of those problems.
Let's go next on the phones to Alan, and there we'll speak with Kirk. Hello, Kirk.
Hi, Chris. Great show. Great topic. And I wanted to applaud Christopher for taking the time and the initiative to bring some facts to light. So, you know, it's a topic that has so many ramifications that we could talk for a long, long time about.
You could write a book about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've been a nutritional cleansing coach myself for the last 4 years, and I've had the good fortune to work with and learn from some of the nation's best-known nutritionists. And one piece that, you know, Jamie Oliver, the chef, is on TED.com doing something similar, very similar to what you're addressing. And thank you, kudos to both of you.
Yeah.
But one thing that is a piece that I'd like to add to this discussion is that in this country, there are four major international food conglomerates that grow most of the food that appears on most of the shelves and ends up on most of the tables in our households in this country and in most of the restaurants.
Sure.
And what people don't know is that this so-called healthy good food is grown in soil that's nutritionally bankrupt, and there's no mineral uptake system, and it's been sprayed with pesticides so that pesticides are part of the food chain, so that even when people are eating food that they are thinking is quote-unquote healthy, good-for-them food, it's definitely a better choice for them than corn dogs or the stuff you were talking about earlier that appears in the food cafeterias in schools. However, the fact that there is no mineral uptake system in the soil in which this food is grown means that people are, you know, are receiving nutritionally bankrupt food even when they believe they're buying really good stuff. So I could go on about this, but I know we're limited on time.
Yeah, what do you think about that, Christopher?
I think there's a lot to be said for those comments, and thank you for bringing that into the discussion. I think that recently, especially, there's been a lot of kind of investigation and more education about that issue specifically. You know, corporate control over the food system, and you know, running those companies in a way to get the costs as low as they can, and that includes, of course, you know, doing some short-term measures like spraying pesticides in order to get the most product, you know, right away. And I think Food Inc. as a documentary was an example of that perspective, and you know, brings a lot of that stuff to light as a film. I found, you know, especially in our research, the book Food Politics by Marion Nessel, who was the dean of food studies at NYU, very helpful in that regard. In addition, the other book that I would recommend on this subject is The End of Food by Paul Roberts. And they speak very specifically not only about big food and the company's role and how they've tried to shape the conversation and shape the food in addition to shaping the things that we actually eat, is very serious. When you have the power of the whole nation's diet rests kind of in the hands and the minds of a few companies, that can be problematic. Doesn't mean it has to be, but definitely can. And some of the issues that the caller's talking about definitely are issues that need to be addressed, both at a policy level and at a general education level.
You write something sort of poignant at the end of the book. After you had finished these experiments and you were sort of going back to real life, it was Carrie's birthday. And so you went out, there were four people, and you went out to dinner.
Yeah.
And in a single meal, spent $125.
Yeah.
And it really struck you.
Yeah, it did. You know, it's one of those things. We were in Los Angeles, and it was her birthday, and her parents had come in from Northern California to surprise her, and it was kind of a big deal. And so they had gone to a lot of expense to come down here and see her on her 30th. And so we were there, and, you know, we hadn't eaten out at, like, a you know, quote-unquote fancy restaurant or more upscale restaurant. And when we say fancy, you know, I assume that that's relative to some folks who are saying, well, that's cheap, you know. But it was a lot for us. You know, when you're looking at $125 to feed, you know, four people, and that includes, you know, beverages and dessert and all that, it really struck me. You know, after doing these two first experiments, you know, you're eating on a dollar a day, and then the next one where you're eating on, you know, the kind of average food stamp allotment plus some extra. It was definitely a shock that we had spent more at that one meal, that one evening, than we had spent in the first experiment in the course of an entire month. In fact, double for two people, and then, you know, about half what we spent for an entire month, on the food stamp challenge. And to spend that in one sitting was definitely eye-opening. And we haven't been back there since, and that's not because of the, you know, not necessarily because of the cost or the distance, but we just haven't. But, recently it came up again. We were invited to this catered, vegan dinner at this restaurant who just recently stopped selling foie gras because of the cruelty involved there. And so they wanted to celebrate the stopping of selling that product with this meal catered to vegans. And I asked her if she wanted to go, and she said, yeah, great. And so we looked at the website, and it was, $70 a person. And I said, I'm sorry, forget it. that's just not something that we can afford at all. That's ridiculous. So, and for those who can't afford it, I'm sure it's going to be great. And I'm very, envious that they can be there and have their palate kind of tantalized in that way. But for us, we couldn't rationalize it.
Well, I wonder now, if you could afford it, if you would still be hesitant to spend that much on a meal.
Well, absolutely. $70 for one person to eat one dinner is absolutely, outrageous if you consider kind of the relativity of the issue of poverty and eating. If I stay home and I, make us something else, say I make us, a soup, freshly made soup, or, even the beans and rice and tortillas from the dollar diet, I could, inevitably take the rest of that money that I would have spent and give it to someone like Oxfam. And I think that the most striking thing that I found recently when thinking about the cost of things is I could do this myself and do it for cheaper and, save money and have kind of, a reasonable quality of life and take the balance and give it to folks who definitely do not. And I think that argument is most strikingly made in the book The Life You Can Save by Peter Singer. And ever since I read that a few months ago, I haven't been able to get that idea out of my head. So instead of spending that $70, I could spend $5 and give the other $65 to Oxfam or to World Hunger Year or another group that's fighting poverty and food injustice.
How has this, we have about 30 seconds left, how has all of this changed your relationship to what you put into your mouth?
It's changed it completely. It's revolutionized it. We were intentional eaters before based on, being vegan, but we are hyper-intentional eaters now. And the way we shop, our daily lives, they've all been revolutionized. No longer do you see boxes of prepackaged foods on our shelves. You see kind of containers of raw ingredients. And so, when you change what you do three times a day, it definitely has a life-changing and revolutionary feeling to it. And so we definitely feel more confident in the way that we're eating. And we're excited to continue learning.
Christopher Greenslate is co-author of On a Dollar a Day, One Couple's Unlikely Adventures in Eating in America. Christopher, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Pleasure's all mine, and I hope that you'll think about what you eat next time you sit down.
Absolutely. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.